First case to be heard this morning is number 2015-336, Columbus City Schools versus Franklin County Board of Revision. And the school board is the appellant, Ms. Fox.
Thank you. Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is Carol Fox. I am with Rich and Gillis Law Group. My Supreme Court number is 0041916, and I'm here today on behalf of the Columbus City Schools Board of Education. This case has some similarities to some other cases that the court has heard recently. If you look at the overall facts being that there were reductions ultimately granted based upon sale documents that were never authenticated or verified. Nobody ever appeared at the Board of Revision or the Board of Tax Appeals. I'm going to not focus a whole lot on issues that I know have already been argued before this court, but would like to bring to the court's attention a distinction in this case, which involves the underlying jurisdictional issue of the complaint. In this case, there was a complaint filed by someone. Because nobody ever participated in any of the five hearings that were set before the Board of Revision or the Board of Tax Appeals, we still today don't know who, in fact, filed that complaint. The complaint listed the owner's name on line 1, lines 2, 3, and 5, all of which inquire as to who the complainant is and the relationship of the complainant to the owner. Those were all left blank. Those were unanswered. The only other thing on the complaint with regard to who filed it was the actual signature. This signature was actually very unclear, and even the BTA determined it to be unintelligible. Next to the signature on the complaint, the word agent was listed. So those are the only things that we know.
But the word agent was not put on one of those previous lines in terms of relationship to the property.
Right. So we have no way of knowing what type of an agency relationship we're dealing with here. We have no way of knowing whether or not the person who filed the complaint had any ownership interest, any fiduciary relationship to the property, met any of the criteria that are required to be a jurisdictionally valid complaint. So we raised this issue at the Board of Tax Appeals. We raised it again, and the BTA, well, first let me back up. At the BTA, we issued discovery. We're still trying to find this information out. We've issued discovery specifically asking who filed the complaint. Please identify this person. Please describe that person's relationship to the owner. Seeking this information. None of it was forthcoming. No answers whatsoever to any of our discovery.
Was the issue raised, well, first of all, did the school board file a counter complaint?
Yes.
Okay.
The school board did file a counter complaint.
And was the issue raised before the BOR?
I believe it was, but I'm not 100% sure. At the Board of Revision, the case was set for hearing three times. On each of those three occasions, nobody showed up for the complainant or the property owner. So the Board of Revision continued to give them more chances. And finally, by the end, I know that there was a motion made to dismiss. I don't know the exact specific grounds that were made at the Board of Revision. I do know, because I handled the Board of Tax Appeals hearing, that I specifically raised the issue there. It was a jurisdictional issue. It could not be waived. If the underlying complaint is faulty and defective, then there is no basis for any reduction by the Board of Revision or the BTA. Because we got no responses to our discovery, we filed a motion for sanctions. We first actually filed a motion to compel. The BTA ordered the owner to comply with our discovery. That didn't happen. So then we were forced to have a sanctions hearing. The owner did not appear at that sanctions hearing, did not offer any response to any of our motions. And then finally, at the Board of Tax Appeals merit hearing, again, we're hoping that maybe somebody will show up and tell us who this person is that signed this complaint. Nobody showed up. Nobody appeared. So finally, after all of those unsuccessful attempts to find out this information, we did, along with our brief, file a motion to remand and dismiss the underlying complaint because we felt like we had done everything we could to try and establish whether or not this complaint was jurisdictionally valid, and there was just simply nothing in the record that showed that it was. If you look at the BTA's decision, what's troubling is that the BTA in its decision specifically says the signature is unintelligible. They then go on to look at the hearsay documents that were apparently mailed in. Again, we have no idea who sent them in. They were sent into the BOR. They were documents that were never identified. They were documents that were the purest, rankest form of hearsay. And so the BTA, recognizing that the signature on the complaint is unintelligible, turns to these hearsay documents, documents that we had objected to, and says, it appears that someone named Alonzo Cruz, quote, may have signed the complaint. Far from being evidence, far from being established who signed the complaint, they're speculating. Maybe this person signed the complaint. And then we're going to dig even deeper into these hearsay documents and say, and if, in fact, this is the guy who signed the complaint, although we don't know that for sure, it appears from these other documents, these hearsay documents, that he might have some capacity with the property as a manager. But again, we don't know. Was it simply a property manager? Was he a member of the owner? We have no way of knowing that. So the problem is that the BTA took huge leaps and bounds to get to its ultimate conclusion, where it specifically found that Mr. Cruz was authorized to sign this complaint. Now, again, we don't know if Mr. Cruz signed the complaint, and we really don't know Mr. Cruz's relationship to the property or the property owner, but yet the BTA specifically found that he had authority to file this complaint. So it is our contention that this finding is absolutely unlawful and unsupported by any reliable and probative evidence, which makes the underlying complaint invalid, and it needs to be remanded all the way back to the Board of Revision with any reductions that were granted for any of the tax years reinstated back to the auditor's values.
And the complaint dismissed.
Correct. The complaint dismissed, the effect of which being that the auditor's original values are reinstated.
So now there is case law that says if this kind of jurisdictional issue is raised, then there is a burden on the party.
On the other side. That's correct.
And so here you're saying this issue was raised by a motion before the Board of Revision.
I am not going to tell you 100% that I think it was this specific issue was raised. I think it was, but I don't know that. I know it was raised at the Board of Tax Appeals 100%.
Okay. And it was raised at the Board of Tax Appeals. First, there was discovery served.
Yes.
That related to this issue.
That's correct.
And then the hearing was held, and then it was after the hearing that the motion to dismiss was filed?
That's correct. It was filed, and we filed a motion to dismiss and a merit brief after the file that dealt with all of the legal issues in the case, the beginning of which is the first thing we moved for was a motion to remand back to the Board of Revision and dismiss for lack of jurisdiction because of a violation of Sharon Village, and there was no evidence. The owner did not respond to any of our motions, to any of our briefs.
And in filing the motions and so forth, there would have been service of those motions. Was that an address that was on the complaint? Or
It would have been, yes, it would have been service. I would have to look at that file particularly, but we would have been serving whomever we were serving with discovery and those types of things. And we did get, we did have communication. So I do know from looking in the file that it wasn't green cards being returned or service unclaimed. Okay. Moving on then to the merits of the case, the other issue with regard to the documents that were relied upon by the BTA, in addition to the fact that those hearsay documents were improperly relied upon by the BTA to somehow validate this complaint when the owner had failed to come forward and really provide any evidence to show that it was a valid complaint, The second goes to certainly the merits of the case itself. The Board of Revision, again, held three hearings. Nobody showed up. Nobody testified. Nobody gave us any information about the sale, whether it was marketed, whether there was any relationship between the parties, what the condition of the property was at the time of the sale as compared to the tax lien date. Unfortunately, we have none of that information. If you look at the documents that they did send in, that again we contend should not have been relied upon at all, but even if you look at those documents, it shows that there was a deed in lieu of foreclosure, there was something going on with this property that indicates there was some sort of financial distress along the way, which raises the red flag, is this really an arm's length sale? We contend that it was the proponent of the sale's burden because, in this case, it was the owner. The owner had all that information. We put forth to this court that the owner had the burden of proving that it was an arm's length sale by doing more than sending in documents. The presumption that I know this court has heard about with respect to simply presenting a conveyance fee or a deed and having that sale be presumed to be arm's length was a presumption that was created for the benefit of parties that don't have access to that information. A board of revision or a board of education has no access to that type of information and has no ability to do discovery, at least at the board of revision level, to find that out. So therefore, we contend that that presumption of a sale being arm's length cannot apply to a property owner if they are not even willing to attend the hearing that they have initiated.
Now, remind me, the board of revision here did accept the sale price and then the school board appealed.
The board of revision accepted the sale price for only one of the years.
Okay.
2010, which was the year in which the property sold, the Board of Revision did accept for that year. 2011 was a reappraisal year for Franklin County. The Board of Revision did not decrease the value for the 2011 triennial. We presume that's because of the face of the complaint indicated there were significant improvements made to the property after the sale, which would have been before the 2011 tax lien date. Additionally, the auditors, appraisers would have had available to them the information about the sale at the time that they were reappraising the property, and for whatever reason, still attributed a higher value to the property in their appraisal. So the Board of Revision decision was 2010, reduction to the sale price, 2011, 12, and 13 carried through, no change. The Board of Tax Appeals, however, applied the sale to all 4 years. So the Board of Tax Appeals did change the Board of Revision value with respect to tax years 11, 12, and 13. Again, based solely upon the hearsay documents that were in the record. The same documents that the Board of Revision had before it considered and rejected. With respect to the hearsay issue, I guess I would like to again point out to the board that courts, for example, the 10th District Court of Appeals has made it clear that although the BTA and the BOR are not strictly bound by the rules of evidence, they cannot establish a value based upon the rankest form of hearsay. And even this court in saying, for example, in Health South Corp., where perhaps some hearsay documents might be reliable, that was only in a case where there was additional evidence, additional reliability proven by other evidence in the record, and we simply don't have that here. What we have here are documents sent in, unverified, no participant in the sale, nobody who can tell us what really happened, and because the Board of Tax Appeals apparently applied some sort of presumption of validity to this sale based strictly on these hearsay documents, it made it impossible for anybody else to disprove this sale. We did everything that we could to obtain information about this sale. We tried, you know, through discovery. We tried to get the owner to appear at 3 Board of Revision hearings, and it never happened. So, in essence, what they're doing is shifting the burden and allowing a property owner to come in, file documents, not show up. If it's truly an arm's length sale and there's nothing wonky about it, why would the owner not show up? What the Board of Tax Appeals is doing by applying this presumption to an owner is encouraging misrepresentations and fraud. Because the owners who are filing on sales and they know there's something that doesn't quite smell right, they're not going to show up. They have no reason to show up. The Board of Tax Appeals is giving them a pass. They're saying, sure, present your documents, don't ever show up, don't ever participate, and we will take your sale. You'll never have to be testifying under oath as to the conditions of the sale. You'll never have to tell us, was it in fact a related party sale? Were there other things involved? You can just simply avoid all those issues by not showing up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. There is no appearance in this case on behalf of appellee, so this case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.